Amen. Good to see you this morning. You know, we tend to believe that cause and effect kind of controls everything. You know, Newton's third law that to every action there is an equal and opposite reaction, which is really true in a closed system. And we like the idea of cause and effect because the truth is we want to be in control of outcomes. And as a result, if we can only believe that if I do this, then this will happen. This was the rich young ruler who came to Jesus and said, "What do I need to do to inherit eternal life?" That sounds so simple. Give me the things I need to do so that I can be right with God. But, you know, and so often that's the motivation behind people's prayers. How do I pray in such a way that God will do what I want him to do? What should we do in order to usher in revival? These are the kinds of things that happen all the time. And then we have people who say that if you want a good relationship, here is how you should act toward your friend or toward your partner, toward your spouse. And if you do this, then this will result. But we know from experience, even though it's comforting to believe that somehow what we do determines all of the outcomes, the truth is we can't fix everything in our life. And Solomon, as we've been studying in Ecclesiastes, makes it really clear. He emphasizes it over and over again that although our actions and choices have consequences, those consequences are sometimes unpredictable because of the God factor. See, Newton writing of a closed system and saying to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction works good until you have someone enter the equation, God, who Thomas Aquinas called him, you know, the uncaused cause. God comes in and he operates outside the system. But what really complicates it is God creates people and gives them a will, gives them choices. So now all of a sudden, what I do cannot flawlessly determine what is going to happen. And obviously, when it's God, the uncaused cause, I can't get God to do what I want him to do either. So ultimately, Solomon's trying to drive home to us, stop thinking that you can control the future. You don't. And you can't. We have to learn. He drives home over and over again. Accept and live in and make the best of now, in the present, in the world in which we live. And if we don't understand that, our lives will be completely frustrating. We'll never find contentment or joy because we can't figure out how come I can't make this happen the way I want it to. Turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. And in this chapter, as we're going through the book of Ecclesiastes now, Solomon gives us a lot more wisdom about this whole notion, about this whole idea that ultimately you can't just make something happen the way that you want it to happen. He starts off in the first six verses reminding us of what he reminds us often. We're all going to die. That's a happy note, I know, to start off with, but that's the way it is. Here in Ecclesiastes 9, he starts out, "For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who doesn't sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead." You know, We sometimes, and just accepting the fact that life is short, is temporary in this world. And again, we're Later on, he talks about under the sun. But let's be honest that, you know, we're all going to die, okay? Now, I understand that that's a hard pill to swallow. And I totally get that you're like, well, wait, I think I'm going to be raptured. I think, you know, 1 Thessalonians 4, I'm going to be caught up. 1 Corinthians 15, we won't all sleep. We'll all be changed in the moment in a twinkling of an eye at the last trumpet and so on. Yeah, basically so far that hasn't happened. I believe that's going to happen. But if you somehow think you're an exception to that, you're playing way against the odds. I remember Pastor Chuck would not like make plans for the future often, even as he was very sick, because he was convinced that he was going to be raptured. So, you know, finally, a couple days before he died, I said, Chuck, you understand you're going to die, right? And he just went, yeah. He nodded his head. And, you know, but if Chuck didn't get raptured, I'm not going to bank on the fact that I'm going to be that exceptional, okay? And that's what Solomon's saying. Not that you couldn't be an exception. It's just that you're probably not as exceptional as you think, according to Solomon. But at the same time, Solomon's going, you got to understand, good people, bad people, people who try hard, people who are flakes, criminals and saints, they all have one thing in common. Someday, this life is going to end for them. And then you see down in verse 4, he continues, but for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. In other words, where there's life, there's hope. The fact that you know you're going to die shouldn't cause you to just be, oh man, I'm just going to give up. You should never give up. You shouldn't, you know, as Dylan Thomas wrote in that beautiful poem for his father, don't go gentle into that good night. Just because you know you're going to die, man, don't make it easy. Understand where there's life, there's hope. While you're still breathing, while you still have potential, while you're still conscious, recognize these days are precious. One of the greatest gifts of being told that you're going to die, which I'm telling all of you now, is that you go, well, life is special. Life is valuable. And Solomon understood that, and he goes on to make it more clear. But then in verses 5 and 6, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. He goes, by the way, did I remember to tell you? You're all going to die. And it isn't about legacy. It isn't about what can you do now that you're going to be remembered for. Solomon over and over again just goes, don't think that you're going to make people remember you and somehow that's worthwhile. You will be amazed at how soon they forget you. You will be amazed at how everything you worked for, as soon as you're gone, they can't wait to get rid of it. They can't wait to get your stuff to a pawn shop or to the Goodwill or Salvation Army so that they can get on with their lives. So he's like, don't get the idea. Now, again, he says under the sun. And on the one hand, we tend to look at when he says under the sun as if he's contrasting that which we know here with eternity, because we tend to be really geared toward and primed toward heaven. Under the sun, though, basically, when it comes to wisdom, it's kind of all we have. All we have is this life. I absolutely believe that when I leave this life, I'm going to go to be with the Lord, but I don't have a lot of wisdom about that. Jesus came from heaven, went back to heaven, ascended to heaven, and he really tells us not that much about it. Paul had this vision where he went above the third heaven and he goes, man, if I told you what it was like, I'd have to kill you. It's the idea that it's out there, it's real, but you better deal with the life in the here and now because that's where you live. That's where we are. Lazarus died for 3 days, came back. As far as we know, he didn't say anything about where he was during that time. Now, before we move on in this, I want to remind us of something that's regarding Solomon. There are people who don't like the book of Ecclesiastes because they just say, Solomon seems so jaded. He just like, this sounds like the ranting of a depressed person. And there are many people who just dismiss the whole book of Ecclesiastes based on Solomon's jadedness and pessimism. But remember, you know, jadedness doesn't mean that something is invalid. In fact, sometimes jadedness is the closest to reality that you're going to get. Much enthusiasm and optimism is based on pretending. It's why people can, you know, look at celebrities and somehow feel a connection with them. Why people can see, you know, rock stars and be like they're your friends or they're somebody that you really, or, you know, you have a sports team. And you're like, what? These are people that get paid ridiculous amounts of money to throw a ball around on the field, and somehow they can make you depressed if they don't hit the ball or if they don't achieve something. It's this delusional lifestyle. And believe me, last year my son Will and I were at the Dodger World Series game that went 18 innings and they won it in the 18th. And it was, I'm not sure I've been as excited since, but they lost the World Series ultimately. And besides that, it costs a lot of money to go to the game. And, you know, but that's what we do. When we feel like I felt at that game, we're probably somewhat delusional. We're probably pretending somewhere along the way. So at some point, when you come out of your delusions and just go, let's look at reality, that is probably going to sound kind of pessimistic to some. But that certainly doesn't make it invalid. I mean, sometimes the truth hurts. And so we go into denial. Sometimes we're like when in A Few Good Men, when Tom Cruise was questioning Colonel Jessup, Jack Nicholson's character, and he's like, you know, I want the truth. And he says, you can't handle the truth. Sometimes that's us. We just don't want the truth because we can't handle it. Sorry. When you come to the book of Ecclesiastes, it's truth. It's truth from the wisest man ever, inspired by the Holy Spirit, shaking us and going, this is reality, okay? This isn't a pep talk. This isn't a saying on a poster or something. This is real life. And there are things that we need to learn from it. And then in verse 7, he shifts to a fairly common theme with him. In light of the fact that we're all going to die, in light of the fact that life is precious, in light of the fact that we're all going to die, then he says this in verse 7. Go, eat your bread with joy. Enjoy a meal. Now, I eat a ketogenic diet, so I would say enjoy your cheese with joy or whatever. But and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you. That would be a good anniversary card. Which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. And then verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Eat bread, drink wine, enjoy yourself. Interesting where it says, God has already accepted your works. He says, what you're doing, the way you're working, God accepts it. The word there for accepted means God's pleased with, he's satisfied. When someone would have a debt satisfied, they would use this Hebrew word. Basically, he says, if you do this, you have done your job. And so, you know, and then again, dress in white. He's not telling people that they should wear white. Whatever this would mean, it would probably be the idea of dress like you're going to a party or dress in a way that feels good to you. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, literally white. But it's the idea of, you know, dress in a way that you are looking to enjoy yourself. Don't dress, in a way that makes you look like, wow, you must be miserable, even if you are. Sometimes you just have to prime the pump and get dressed up a little bit. I'm going to have to work on that. But, you know, and then live joyfully with your wife. Now, that's kind of an interesting one. Obviously, it only applies to someone who has a wife. And for Solomon, he had 700 of them. So I don't know if he meant you should just stick with the one you have, or if he, maybe Solomon, with all those wives running through, maybe he was like Stephen Stills, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. But at any rate, whatever situation that you're in, basically what it says to us is find joy in your relationships. Find joy in the connections that you have. And if you're married, do it joyfully. Find ways to enjoy and appreciate your relationship. And then as he says, this is your portion there in verse 9. You know, it's your job to do. It's your share of life. It's really, this is equivalent to the New Testament Greek word meros. This is your destiny. This was a word that was used when they divided up the land and they said, here's your portion. So he says, finding joy in relationships, that's your part. That's what you do. God is pleased when you do that. And then I think verse 10 is a real key when he says, so whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. The Hebrew word there, koach, is a word that means do it vigorously, be determined. It's tough. It's actually what the word means literally is a chameleon. And so it's the idea of staying with something. But, you know, a chameleon's really flexible. That's how they, the thing that makes chameleons so tough isn't just that they can fight with somebody, because they don't. It's that they know how to blend in when they need to. They can work through life and amazingly how they survive. And so he's like, whatever you do, do it like that. Do it like it's going to last. Do it like you're going to fit in. It's similar to the idea that Paul says in Colossians 3:23 when he says, whatever you do, do it heartily. That means literally the words there are out of soul. Do it from the soul. Do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. So, you know, Solomon's just going, you're going to die. There's so much that you can't control. So what is in your life right now? Do it from the heart. Do it for real. Do it passionately. Do it joyfully. Find the pleasure that is available to you at this stage of your life. And by the way, I don't think it's a coincidence that he applies work and effort in verse 10 to what precedes it. Because the truth is, effort is what supports the other things that you actually enjoy. If you're like, boy, I'd like to have a nice meal and celebrate, but I can't afford it. Well, maybe doing things, working hard on it, is what's supposed to, and Solomon says it's a lot. That's what gives you the ability to be able to enjoy life. Maybe you're like, I don't have anybody in my life to enjoy. Well, maybe there are things that you could work on, like changing your wardrobe or other things that might change that. I don't know. The thing is, how valuable is it to you to have a relationship? Then do you from your heart with a strength decide to do the things that are going to make that possible? Something to think about. But at any rate, Solomon's just going, do what you can to enjoy life here and now. Control what you can because there's so much that you can't control. And then in verse 11, he gets to this cause and effect thing. And he says, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. Fast people don't always win. The battle is not to the strong. Strong people don't always prevail. Nor bread to the wise. Being wise sometimes doesn't make you wealthy. Or riches to men of understanding. Nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. Time and chance. Boy, does that fly in the face of the notion of cause and effect. That he basically says, you know what? Whatever you do, Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and you can't necessarily point the finger at exactly why, because this world isn't set up for you to be able to make things happen the way that you want. We are so uncomfortable with the notion of time and chance, you know? But he wants us to understand, life is not about, if I do this, then God will do this. And there are so many people who are disappointed in God because God won't let you control him. Because God won't let you control the people in your life. Because sometimes you just have, you might have done everything right and you just get reamed by somebody. Sometimes that's it. You're just not lucky, according to Solomon. You know, cause and effect certainly aren't clear, and you'll never enjoy life until you accept the fact that life isn't fair. That life doesn't just give you everything that you think you deserve. Don't count on your work always paying off. I saw this for years in working in a school where some of the students that poured all of their effort into getting the best grades possible so that they could get into the best schools, and then after sacrificing their entire youth, they realized that I just didn't get into the school I wanted to get into. Or I got into it and it's not what I thought it was. Or like athletes who their parents push them into, you know, year-round sports and everything because it's going to get a scholarship. And then they either don't or they burn out on the sport. It just happens. You cannot count on, if you do this, then this will happen. I knew a guy one time who promised his daughter that your senior year of high school, you will get asked out on a date, I'm sure of it. And it didn't happen, and it was kind of, she had been homeschooling, and now he had her go to school, because then she's going to get her first date. And it's like, wow, now how do you explain? He was trying to talk guys into asking her out and everything else. Just don't count on your work paying off. Don't work, don't do things just because there's a guarantee in the future, because the future doesn't have guarantees. Your life isn't even guaranteed in the future. Sometimes, Solomon would say, you're just not lucky. Stuff happens. Sometimes it just stinks to be you. You know, I remember a story about a guy who was on his deathbed, and his wife was there by his side, and he said to her, honey, you've been here with me the whole time. You were here when I got drafted into the military. You signed up as a nurse so that you could be with me. When I was shot in action, you nursed me back to health. When we had our kids, you were there with me. When they were sick and when they were difficult, when they were in trouble, you were there. Later, as my career went south, you were standing by my side. And when I got sick and now I'm ready to die, here you are again. He said, honey, you're bad luck. Stuff just happens. Sometimes you're not lucky. Should be okay with that. Now, we often as Christians who are so used to people telling you, leading you with a carrot and a stick, we're uncomfortable with the idea of random luck. But God isn't uncomfortable with it. In fact, he says, God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Stuff just happens. Now, you want to balance this for sure. There's an old saying that says, I'm a great believer in luck. The harder I work, the luckier I get. Originally, people credited that with Jefferson, but they can't find anything where Jefferson actually said it. Other people say it was Samuel Goldwyn, but there are people who said it long before him. But the thing is, it's true. The harder you work, the luckier you'll get, but it's not foolproof. Sometimes things just happen, and your success in life will be much more determined by how you react and respond to what happens than it will ever be determined, you know, by just you making things happen the way that you want them to. And then beginning with verse 13 and on through verse 18, he lets us know wisdom is valuable, but it isn't always appreciated or rewarded. This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, verse 13. And it seemed great to me. It seemed like a great insight. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, And he, by his wisdom, delivered the city, yet no one remembered that same poor man. He was a hero to the city. He applied his wisdom, but I can't remember his name. Nobody really knows who he is. Then I said, verse 16, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Wisdom, as he says, isn't popular. Wisdom is really valuable and good, but generally don't expect wisdom to become the prominent, emphasis for most of the people. It's why, even though it's probably true that a representative form of government, or we commonly call it a democracy, it's not totally that, but it may be a bad system, but it's probably better than other systems. But the thing that's scary is just look at what some of the crazy opinions that people have and ask yourself, this person's voting? This is someone who's going to determine our future? Generally, and I've said this many, many times, if you've listened to me much, you've heard it. I had a seminary professor who said that, in the beginning there were two people and they took a vote and it was unanimous and they were both wrong. And the majority has been wrong ever since. Wisdom is valuable, but it's unappreciated. Don't expect people to generally have wisdom. And as in this story here of the guy that saved the city, sometimes wisdom's best work is anonymous. Sometimes it's something that won't make someone famous or successful. Some of the most profound things that I've ever heard people say are people that you've never heard of. And also, don't expect wisdom to pay off. It very seldom does. It quite often, wisdom becomes something that it's there, people don't respond to it, and in the end, it's unappreciated completely. Pagan religions are all superstitious and magical. Pagan religions always operate on the idea that if you do the right stuff, follow the right rituals and protocols, magic will happen. In pagan religions, in superstitions, you can control other people, you can control the forces of nature, you can control God himself. But that's pagan, magical nonsense. It doesn't work that way. Now, I'm not saying I don't believe in magic and the supernatural. I emphatically do. And I've seen God do too many miracles for me to ever become purely naturalistic, to be just submitted simply to, that which is random. I don't believe that. But when God interrupts the flow of natural events and their randomness, it is the rare exception. It's not a response to someone doing the right thing. You can see things in the Old Testament in Joshua's battle where God lengthened the day. Yeah, God can do that. He could do it again. But if you think that, you're the one that he's going to do it through, try it and see what happens. Find out how much power you actually have to counteract the forces of nature. God spoke clearly to certain prophets, to men like Moses and Daniel and Elijah and others. And that was awesome. But he did it very sparingly. There would be hundreds of years when God never said anything to anyone. And so if you think that every thought that comes into your head, you're like, yeah, God's speaking to me all the time, you're either the greatest prophet in all of history, or more likely, you might be schizophrenic and you ought to talk to somebody about that. God has healed people, and he can, but we need to understand, he doesn't heal most people. When Jesus was here on the earth, he healed a lot of people, but he left a lot more people still ill and suffering, because ultimately we all get sick and we all die at some point. We can't use God as a way of gaining control. Life doesn't work that way, and God doesn't work that way. I have to find a way to respond to reality in a way that I can practically make the best of reality, rather than to look at every situation and imagine and fantasize how, if I was God, how I might change things. Because God is God, and he has reasons, I suppose, why there are certain things that he doesn't change. Sometimes I wish I were God. I'd do things differently than God, but I'm sure he's a better God than I am. But by the way, I see miracles all around me. And usually they're miracles of response and acceptance, not of control. And a miracle of response and acceptance is much more profound than a miracle that subverts the laws of nature, that subverts the bad things that have just happened or occurred to you. Miracles, real miracles, you know, I think of single moms who are in a position of trying to raise their kids without support. My own mother, who, with her husband in and out of mental hospitals, finally just gone. We never saw him again. She was abused from when she was a little girl as a Okie, and, you know, coming to California, marrying someone who was 18 years her senior, who was schizophrenic, and dealing with all of that, raising five children, working hard, and yet she'd get out in the yard with me and play catch so that I would have that experience that a kid might need to be able to do sports. She later went blind from her type 1 diabetes, and she still got around. We'd be down in Huntington Beach, and there she is on the pier. And she figured out how to, she had her little cane and figured out how to use the system. She would come here to church until right before she died. And it was an ordeal for her to get here. But I look at that, and after everything that she had been through, she still believed in Jesus. She still believed in the Jesus that she taught me as a kid. She did all kinds of things that were wrong. It's understandable. That's the way it is. And she was the victim of an awful lot of bad breaks. But at the same time, I looked at her to where she believed in God till the moment that she saw him as she went into heaven. That's amazing. She would have every reason in the world to reject him. I think of people who struggle with debilitating diseases and pain for years, and yet they still have positive attitudes. It's a way bigger miracle for someone to deal with their pain and with a smile on their face than it is for someone to be like, oh, I hurt a little bit, poof, and you're fixed. You know, and most of the people that are suffering with positive attitudes, they do it even without therapy dogs. I saw a therapy dog attack someone in the airport the other day, but it's a miracle when people lose loved ones. Watching them suffer, suffering with them, losing them, and continuing to go on with their life, continuing to care about, and, you know, after suffering with someone, now facing a future without them. It's a miracle when, like, I think of some missionaries who give up everything to just go and serve the Lord. Rose Martinez is one of our missionaries who, as a teenage girl, went to Thailand on a short-term missions trip. And, you know, got there, and the missionary she was supposed to be working with for a couple weeks had left, and Rose just has this whole orphanage, and she's been there her entire life, and it's raised all these children, and, you know, it didn't always pay. I mean, she was in the middle of, in southern Thailand, after the tsunami hit, Rose was down there with everyone else lifting dead bodies and stacking them up. She had a guy who was her most trusted person who would have taken over the whole ministry eventually, but he stabbed her in the back and burned her, did some things that were horrible. But at the same time, she just keeps serving God. She continues to do that with a great attitude. And she said just a couple days ago, she wrote an email and talked about that she went and saw the guy who was the first baby that she had in the orphanage. He's 50 years old now. And he is in a Southeast Asian country that you're not supposed to do what he's doing. He has a church. He's pastoring a church, and she got to go to that church, a church that's reaching people who are treated horribly within their culture. And she said she came there, and she was just like, here's my first baby. Here's my oldest son. And look what, and he came up to her, and he bowed down, And he asked her to pray for him in front of their church. That's more amazing than whatever she could have accomplished doing something else. I'm always amazed at the miracle of marriages that last. The odds are so much tipped against you, and some people just hang in there for a long time. It's inspiring. But I'm equally inspired by people who have a second marriage, and that's even harder. And they tackle that, and they're willing to take that risk, and they make that happen, and they thrive in a relationship that involves a lot more complications. That's miraculous. Kids who survive abuse and grow up to be well-adjusted. See, we've got to accept, man, life is short and it's precious and we are all terminal, and most of our miracles are going to look like, look how you responded to that adversity. You got a bad break. It was the wrong time. It was the wrong luck. And yet, you're hanging in there. You're continuing to live a successful life. Give up on controlling life, controlling circumstances, controlling people, and controlling God. If you set your goal in life to control anyone other than you, you will be sorely disappointed. Treasure life enough to actually work at enjoying it. God says it's your job to enjoy life as you have it, with those who are in your life, in the ways that you can. So work like crazy so that you are able to enjoy life, because God would say that's one of your most important jobs to do that. But also, obviously, be prepared for life after death. Don't live this life, and as Solomon winds up the book in the last chapter, he's like, look, when it all comes down to it, be in a relationship with God. Fear God and keep his commandments. Do things the way he says to. And so I am living in the present. I'm trying to make the best of the present. I'm trying to let go of the notion that somehow I can magically change people and things and God. But at the same time, I want to know where the Bible would say what happens to me after this short life is over. And if I have that resolved, I'm freed up to actually make the best of life, to actually enjoy life. As much as we live in the present, it would be foolish to not know where we stand in the future. If you're here, you're listening today, and you're just not sure what's going to happen to you in the end, that's probably going to really get in the way of you having complete joy in your life now, because it's constantly going to be nagging away at you. It's really foolish to live your life without knowing where you stand with God, especially when it's so easy, when it's free. There was an old story about a king who had his favorite jester. And this jester could always make the king laugh, could always help him to feel like, my problems aren't so bad. And he wanted to set the jester free, but there wasn't a legal way for him to free a slave. So what he did is he gave him his scepter and he said, your job now is to go out in the whole world, wherever you go, and find someone more foolish than you are. And when you find someone more foolish than you, hand them the scepter and you will have earned your freedom. The jester was out there for years, walking around with this scepter, couldn't find anyone. He was a humble guy, couldn't find anyone that he thought was more foolish than he was. Finally, the king found out that he was sick and dying, and he called for his favorite jester to come back. And he told the jester, he said, I'm about to go away on a long journey. And the jester said, well, where are you going? He said, well, I'm not really sure. And he said, well, have you prepared for this journey? And the king said, no, I really haven't. The jester handed him his scepter back and said, if you're going on a journey and you don't know where you're going and you haven't prepared for it, you're more foolish than I am. If today you're in a place where you don't know, you don't have an assurance of where you're going after you die, you will never be able to enjoy life the way you could, knowing that your eternity is in God's hands, that it's already been taken care of. When God says, if you will just trust in Jesus, then your eternity is set. Now you get that set and you focus your attention on your job now. How can you make the best of life? How can you enjoy your relationships and your possessions and your time? How can you appreciate and enjoy it the most? What makes it easy to do is when you know you're already going to be fine in the future. You don't have to be constantly thinking about the future because you have the word of Jesus on it. You're actually not going to die. It's just going to look like it. When you believe in me, you will pass on into a life that is, you can't even imagine what it's going to be like. So if you have never really entered into that understanding with God, if you've never received Jesus, and you're just like, well, I don't know, I'll let it pan out when it is, you're a fool. When it's so simple, I pray that today, if you don't know where your eternity stands, that you would just come down. There'll be people down here in the front who would love to pray with you and introduce you to a relationship with Jesus. Your sins can be forgiven today, and you can be absolutely right with God for free. And I pray that you'll just do it. Then once that's resolved, now you can get back to the job that we all have. How can I make the best of life as it is, of the situations that I find myself in? How can I respond in a way that gives me joy and contentment? But get that eternity taken care of first. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this dose of truth from such a wise man, Solomon. Help us not to spend a bunch of our lives, as Jesus said, working for something that will never satisfy. Help us to fully enjoy the opportunities that life gives us, because we know that our ultimate future is secured, that we don't have to think about it or obsess on it or argue about it. It's set because we have responded to the offer from Jesus that if we believe in him, it's set. So for anyone here, Lord, who doesn't know you, help them to understand this can be resolved here and now, and give them the courage to come down to receive prayer. For all the rest of us, Lord, for all the times we live in a fantasy world where we think everything depends on us, and we get disappointed when we don't get to control you or others or circumstances, help us to find contentment in a world that's often random because you created it that way for a reason. Thank you for being with us and walking with us through life and all that it offers and all the pain that it brings and giving us a way to find joy in the process. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.